From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll talk with jazz drummer and composer Max Roach. He was one of the first and most influential of the modern jazz drummers, and he's still at the forefront of jazz. Also today, I'll talk with character actor Robert Loggia. He got an Academy Award nomination for his role as the private investigator in The Jagged Edge. He plays a cop in the new film, The Believers. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Fleetwood Mac album, Tango in the Night. And our movie critic Stephen Schiff looks at the new Steve Martin film, Roxanne. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is drummer and composer Max Roach. He's one of the inventors of modern jazz drumming. Together with Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, Roach helped formulate the language of bebop. In the mid-50s, Roach teamed up with trumpeter Clifford Brown to form what many jazz fans regarded as the quintessential bop group of the time. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz music inspired by the civil rights movement. Since then, Roach has continued to experiment with new forms. His score for a Sam Shepard play won an Obie Award. Last year, Roach collaborated with Alvin Ailey's dance troupe on Survivors, a tribute to Nelson and Winnie Mandela. Max Roach is also a professor of music at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He has a new album that's called Bright Moments on the Soul Note record label. It features his double quartet, that is, his jazz quartet, along with a string quartet. Before we meet Max Roach, let's listen to a piece from Bright Moments. This is Double Delight.
Thank you.
guest is Max Roach, and we heard a selection from his new album, Bright Moments. Max Roach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
You're really trying something different in this new album. You have your jazz quartet and a string quartet.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, you know, that like Charlie Parker with recorded with strings, but
yes.
It was very pop, dressy, kind of schlocky strings in a way. And you're trying to use strings in a different way for jazz. What's your vision with this?
Well, I'm thinking about strings out front, so to speak. excuse me. It's the string quartet is an integral part of the musical action as well as the soloist. Usually, the rhythm section is the second line, and the front line is the horns, piano, etc. But since we aren't using a piano, I wanted to have the string quartet as prominent a part of the music as the saxophone, trumpet, bass, drums, etc. The whole group, everybody is really the front line, as it was the conception. So that's why Double Delight, which is a composition by a young trombonist, Steve Turing, who's making quite a name for himself as a performer and as a composer in New York, he caught the essence of the conception. You know, our first LP was Easy Winners. And plus the fact that my my daughter, the idea originated from my mother. My mother said, "Well, you've made records." My daughter went to graduated from Oberlin and went to Europe to study with Primrose. She's the violist in the group, and she actually organized the quartet. She found the personnel. She found four very talented young women. We'll talk about it a little later, of course, but. She said to me one day, she said, "You know, after my daughter had come back from Europe, she says, you've recorded with Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, and Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis, and Bud Powell, and all these folks. When are you going to do something with Maxine?" That's my daughter's name. So I said, "You know, Mom, I never thought about it." And that was the germ of the idea. Then years later, of course, I began to say, I want to do something with strings, not as, say, a horn player. And some very good things were done, of course, Bobby Hackett and Clifford Brown, as well as Charlie Parker, but in a different vein. I wanted to as a drummer, to bring the strings right out front, of course, because now I'm not going to play ballads, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes strings are used to dress something up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's not what you're doing with
No, this. I wanted them to work just as hard as, say, the saxophone soloists or the trumpet soloists.
Now, sometimes if you hear a drummer leading a group, you assume that the drummer's always going to be at the forefront. There's going to be seven really loud drum solos throughout. And that's not the case
in
your group either.
No, you... to balance a recording, this should be just balanced. It should be something fast, something medium, something slow, something a little romantic, such as Tyrone Brown's dedication to Duke Ellington, you know, that piece, so forth.
My guest is drummer Max Roach. I'd like to talk about your life a little bit. You got your start, I think, playing in Coney Island for at sideshows, is that right?
That's true. We used to do sometimes 12, 14 shows a day, and we'd have a barker outside. It was a barker who'd say, "Come on in," and the girls would go out and shake a little bit, and then the public would come in. We'd do, say, a 40-minute show and have 20 minutes off, and they'd go back out. It's a real side show. I enjoyed it.
What kind of music did you play?
Well, we played everything from small group versions of Cacciatorean pieces where we were the fire eaters, ladies would dance and put fire all over themselves, and a comedian would say a few jokes, and a lot of fine musicians, dancers and choreographers had to do that for a living. I did it during the summers, you know. And
you were a teenager then.
Teenager, and that was it. You know, in order to master, I guess, your instruments, you have to do everything. I played with the local symphony orchestra, played... the Coney Island sideshows, and played with marching bands. Just have drums will travel, so to speak, was my credo at that time.
Were you different than the other drummers who were playing in the same kinds of bands you were at the time? Did you know that you were doing something different?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so it's right next door, of course, to Manhattan. And I think we all did the same thing. Some of the guys dropped out. Some people, they got married or went to the post office or whatever, but there were some marvelous music. I grew up with some marvelous musicians.
How did you first meet some of the people who you became very close with and made now classic music together with? I'm thinking of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Did they find you? Did you find them?
Well, Dizzy Gillespie heard me at a jam session in a place called Monroe's Uptown House. Clark Monroe was the brother-in-law of Billie Holiday's first husband, Jimmy Monroe, and he was like a kind of a patron for young talent in these after-hour clubs. These after-hour clubs would open up at 4 in the morning and go until 8, so we could work those places and still go to school, Bud Powell and a crowd of us. Well, he heard me. He was with Cab Calloway. He heard me. He says, someday when I get my own band, when I leave Cab Calloway, I would like for you to play for me. That's how I met Dizzy, and Dizzy introduced me to Coleman Hawkins. I got my first record date. And Dizzy was kind of like the catalyst of that whole movement that we call bebop. You know, he brought Charlie Parker, he discovered, in a way, you know, he brought Charlie Parker to New York and Bud Powell and all these wonderful people. He kind of had a group around him, you know, and I was just fortunate enough to be part of that, but that's how I really got started.
You were one of the first drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. It was a period where instrumental virtuosity was in our area, in the jazz area, was now prevailed. Because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cabaret taxes, very complex. Simply, to put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. And upon that, he had, on top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. So everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before? And what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to, invent new rhythms.
Yeah,
you had
to invent new styles. I had help, too. I had a lot of help. I had my mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb and Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band, for folks who don't know. These were people who played with Louis Armstrong, and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band context. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us, actually. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that first small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. And that's, but we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. ¶¶ That was Coco, as recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
sure
much?
It sure does. It'd be Charlie Parker at that time, as well as Dizzy. The music was very, very fresh, and I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene, and they would say things, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles, and Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales, and Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand, and it was we were criticized, but some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go, you know.
Well, I want to talk some more about your life and your music, but we're going to take a short break here. My guest is drummer and composer Max Roach. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Drummer and composer Max Roach is my guest. And by the way, he has a new recording out called Bright Moments that features him along with his double quartet. You know, the period that you were playing, you were talking about how radical you were. And the musicians were not only radical in their music, but radical in their style as well, and the kind of clothes that many of the musicians wore, berets and everything. And there was a language of the music. And I was wondering if you were ever plagued by hipsters who wanted to, you know, talk hip to the musicians and wanted to hang out with the musicians.
Well, some of the writers were influenced by the music, like Kerouac. He was really into it, so he created a style of writing that had no periods or anything to it. You know, well, I don't know whether he created it or not, but he felt that. And then there was the painter.
Pollock, are you thinking of?
Yeah, Pollock, who also was influenced by it. He had a conception of what improvisation was within this mode that was created by the boppers at that time. And you're right, there were people who came, ooh, papa, da, and ooh, lua. You know, there were people who would come up to us and talk that language. Yeah.
Was this the life you had planned on when you wanted to become a jazz musician? Because you started playing at a time when the big bands were still around. And being a jazz musician meant going on tour with Earl Hines or Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, one of the big bands. But you actually came of age. You know, you grew right after that. Mm-hmm. You came of age in a time when it was small groups, as you were saying before. And the life just became very different.
It did. Well, I hadn't planned on really becoming taking jazz music that seriously at the time. But the war and all the things that did happen. And then while I was in my senior year at Boys High, I'd met this gentleman, Clark Monroe, and worked in his after-hour club. Well, Sonny Greer, Duke's great drummer, was ill, and most of the great drummers were in the Army, like Joe Jones, Sidney Catlett, et cetera. I could read music. So, Clark, because in those after-hour spots you played, as I said before, for Shake Dance, you played Cachaturian, you did all kinds of things. And when Sonny Greer got sick, Duke Ellington called Mr. Monroe up did he know a drummer who could play a show? Duke was at the New York Paramount. He said, I got a kid who works at my club that plays a show. And I went down to the New York Paramount, make a long story short, got on the stage and looked at Mr. Greer's music stand. There was no music stand and no music. And I couldn't play by ear at that time. You know, I was about 17. So everything was by ear. So Mr. Ellington, before the curtain came up, he looked at me and saw the fright, the fear in my face and said, keep one eye on me and one eye on the act on the stage. And I made it through, but then I made up my mind I wanted to be in this area of the music because Duke had all the theater and the drama and the pageantry was just surrounded him when he presented a show. And that's when I really decided that was what I wanted to do.
In the 1960s, in the early 1960s, you started to play music inspired by the civil rights movement. Mm. Had you become an activist then?
Well, I guess we always have been, you know. It was just something that you, people ask me that quite often, but I go back to Bessie Smith with Black Mountain Blues and then to Duke Ellington with his Black, Brown, and Beige. And it's always been there. Had Ledbetter always spoke about the issues and the times that existed. And many of the old Black folk singers from the South, the street musicians, dealt with it. And so to me, it was just I had an opportunity to say something, and I used them. In fact, the suite was commissioned by the youth movement of the NAACP, and we premiered it here in Philadelphia at one of their conventions. That's what it was. In 1960, we were originally commissioned to do something for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, and so that's how it came about.
Was it at all risky for you to do politically inspired music? Were you going to? Did you run into any trouble in getting recording dates afterwards or club dates because of your involvement in the civil rights movement? And you know, I don't think so.
I'll tell you what did happen that was very positive. It sneaked into South Africa, or rather, it went into South Africa. It didn't sneak in. It was taken into South Africa as a jazz musician's album until people read the liner notes put out by Nat Hentoff, and the pieces were a comment. Because Oscar Brown Jr., of course, was the lyricist on the work. It was a comment on the things that happened in Sharpeville, the massacre, and things like that. So when the authorities in South Africa realized that this was not just simply a jazz album, they banned it and hit the UPI and AP, and it became a celebrity record. And it sold more records, I guess, than anything I had ever made at that time. So something came out of it because of that. And the musicians from South Africa, like Hugh Masekela and Dollar Brand, they were listening and buying it and taping it and things like that. But it's amazing how things turn around, see? So the Freedom Now Suite, I've always been an activist. At that time, of course, my children were young, but you're always thinking about, you know, their future as well. And it has to be, if they're going to come up and be responsible human beings, they have to have education and have things like everyone else has. And the society has to accommodate that. So I guess I've always been an activist because of that. Mm-hmm.
You were one of the most influential drummers in modern jazz. And, well, some of the people who you played with died tragic deaths from overdoses or car accidents. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of terrible things had happened to musicians. You're not only a survivor, but you've kept changing. You know, your music has kept progressing. And I wonder if there was ever any temptation to just keep doing what you had become famous for, as many artists do.
Well, you know, Terry, what happened, it's like being at the university. You either publish or perish. I mean, in the recording industry, the first thing they ask you is, Max, what do you have new? When you want to record, you say, well, I'm going to repeat myself. They say, well, you've already done the things that, of course, we couldn't anyway with Clifford Brown, as great as that music is, or was, or, and still is, or with Charlie Parker. You cannot repeat yourself. Sometimes you miss because you're always trying for other things. I think one of the leading exponents of dealing with that problem is Miles Davis. I mean, I think what he does, when he changes, is significant and it works. As far as I'm concerned. But you have to change in the business. You cannot repeat yourself if you are, quote, a supposedly creative artist. And the record companies, of course, are like that. They say, well, maybe jazz went into a commercial decline. I mean, it was put on the back burner for a few years. It seems to be coming back out now. But it could have been because everybody was the same. You know, there wasn't anything. And, of course, the producers and the musicians, they tried all kinds of things. They tried fusion. That means you play jazz this and add some rock or whatever. Some of it worked, and some of it worked, and some of it did not. And some of the musicians were destroyed from it, some of the great ones. Because the public, if you make a record that is flat-out commercial and in a rock scene, when you go to play something serious, say, like some of the repertoire of Thelonious Monk and some of the players, Herbie Hancock can do it and gets away with it. But he's an exceptionally gifted young musician. Maybe that has something to do with why jazz was on the back burner. But it's coming right out front again, and it looks good.
Well, you're doing very well.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today and talking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been drummer and composer Max Roach, and he has a new album on the Soul Note record label that's called Bright Moments. It features his double quartet. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with DJ Fontana and Paul Burleson, members of the band The Sun Rhythm Section. DJ Fontana used to play with Elvis Presley. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, character actor Robert Loggia talks about his recent roles, a cocaine dealer in Scarface, a private investigator in The Jagged Edge, and a cop in the new film The Believers. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Tango in the Night, the first new album in 5 years from Fleetwood Mac. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Roxanne, the comedy based on Cyrano de Bergerac, starring Steve Martin and Daryl Hannah. And we'll check in with National Public Radio in Washington for the latest news. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news. This is Fresh Air. Tango in the Night is the group Fleetwood Mac's first album in 5 years. Three members of the band put out solo albums in the intervening time. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has these thoughts on Fleetwood Mac reunited. But first, a sample of the album. This is Big Love.
Looking out for love in the night so still. Oh, how dim your kingdom in that house on the hill. Looking out for love.
Fleetwood Mac was one of the reasons rock and roll during the 1970s wasn't a complete loss. Albums like the one called Fleetwood Mac in 1975 and Rumors in 1977 were amazing, startling records. The fury and force of a song like Go Your Own Way with singers Lindsey Buckingham and Christine McVie yelling into a squalling storm of guitars, was like an explosion on the radio. A 70s pop band, which was the way Fleetwood Mac had positioned themselves in the music business marketplace, just wasn't supposed to be this unruly, this eccentric, this aggressive. Fleetwood Mac recently put out its first album in 5 years. It's called Tango in the Night. In the space of those 5 years, the landscape of rock has changed. Bruce Springsteen and Michael Jackson have loomed large in the last half decade. Ballad singers like Whitney Houston have softened the tone of the music. A decade ago, a smart pop band like Fleetwood Mac had to confront the raucous screams of punk rock. You had to issue a position paper, pro or con, on it, and that's what Fleetwood Mac did with Tusk, a double album they put out in 1978. Nowadays, Fleetwood Mac's Tango in the Night has nothing more important to address than Whitney Houston's glossy crooning and U2's sanctimonious preachifying. As a result, Tango in the Night tends to be a rather listless record. There's no sense of urgency in it. You get the feeling that the greatest motivation to record this music was that it was a wise financial decision. Still, there are bits of startling oddity on Tango in the Night, most of them coming from singer Stevie Nicks, who has always traded on her own oddness. Here's a selection from Fleetwood Mac's Tango in the Night, a song written and sung by Stevie Nicks called Welcome to the Room, Sarah.
And it's not terror, in fact. Do I know you? Have I been here before? This is a dream, right? Deja vu, did I come here on my own? Oh, I see. Welcome to the room, Sarah, for starlings.
That was a cut from the new Fleetwood Mac album, Tango in the Night. Stevie Nicks has become the best-known member of the band, primarily by virtue of her husky voice singing, the sort of doe-eyed good looks that inspire the status of rock and roll sex symbol, and that rather delirious songwriting style. The song I just played, Welcome to the Room, Sarah, seems to me a striking pop song, moody and ominous in a way that the lyrics never really make clear. In fact, like most Stevie Nicks songs, even the ones you hear over and over again on the radio, it's impossible to figure out what the heck is going on in that lyric, who Stevie is in thrall to, who she's addressing, who this darn Sarah is. Stevie Nicks is the only rock and roll sex symbol who has arrived at that position by wearing outdated clothes. She still favors platform boots and the sort of tatterdemalion shawls that hippie bands in the 60s wore when they called their female vocalists chick singers. Stevie Nicks is a chick singer for the 80s, by which I mean she transforms her flightiness into art. That's why it doesn't really matter whether her lyrics are up to much. They're used as the rock vocal equivalent of a diary. And by saying that, I don't mean to put down either Nix's songwriting or diaries. The first has yielded some terrific music, and the second has its place in literature. In a way, that's why the two songs Stevie Nicks has contributed to Tango in the Night, the one I just played and another called Seven Wonders, are the album's best, because they don't need the outside world. Nicks is capable of making narcissism interesting at a time when being narcissistic is one way to get a hit on the pop charts.
Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
A long ago, certain place, certain time.
You're listening to Fresh Air. Robert Loggia is a character actor. You'd probably recognize his face and voice, but not necessarily his name. In the movie Scarface, he played the drug kingpin who brings Al Pacino into the business.
You see that fat bastard as Nacho Contreras?
El Gordo.
He's got more cash than anybody in this place. He's a real hothead. You know what a hothead is?
No, Frank, you tell me. What do you say, Hassan?
It's a Yiddish word for pig. It's a guy.
In Jagged Edge, he was the hard-boiled private eye who helped a lawyer played by Glenn Close on a murder case.
All right. I've got 832 pages signed, sealed, and delivered by Thomas Krasny, Esquire, The People versus John C. Forrester.
It really took Krasny 2 months to put this together?
Christ's sake, Teddy, he's got him tied to that knife.
No, he doesn't. He has a janitor who claims to have seen a knife in the locker.
And in his new film, The Believers, Loggia plays a tough Irish New York City cop who investigates a series of ritual murders.
Oh, Christ. You see what they did to that kid in there? Did you see?
I saw. What do you know about it?
They took my badge!
Who took your badge? Who took it? Who took it, Tom? Come on.
You don't know what they could do to me.
You did a good job on this one. Now we're on top of it. You got to let us have it. We're going to go down to the station house and we're going to make a report.
Robert Loggia began acting in New York in the early 50s. He's now 57. He's played a lot of heavies and cops in his career. I asked him why he thinks he gets cast in those roles.
I guess I have a kind of an urban quality. I was born and brought up in New York. It's fortunate that I'm right for that. I suppose if we were dealing with a lot of pictures that... we'll say cowboys and more from rural areas with thick southern accents, I might not be working so much. So it's kind of fun.
In The Believers, you play an Irish cop in New York, a police lieutenant. What did you do to get into that role? You grew up in New York. You've met a lot of New York cops in your time. But what did you do to really get into it?
I know what an Irish cop is as opposed to an Italian cop or a Jewish cop or a German cop or whatever, that the quintessential holy name society Irish cop. I know him, and I wanted to deliver him to the screen.
In The Jagged Edge, you played a private investigator working closely on a murder case with the lawyer played by Glenn Close. A lot of critics and viewers really started paying very serious attention to you after that role. It got you an Academy Award nomination. It seemed to me to be the kind of role that wasn't necessarily that well fleshed out in the script. I just had a feeling that a lot of what was interesting about the role was what you brought to it. Was it a role like that where you had to really partially invent the character?
Yes, you're quite right. I think whatever I've done, up to this point, has been in the main been working with very little on the script and indeed very little time on the screen compared to what else is happening. Certainly Sam Ransom in Jagged Edge, even by you could tell by the way it's perceived, you know, when you setting up the shots, say, and the studio publicity, that this was considered a very peripheral character. But then about a couple of weeks into the film, Marty Rantzehoff, the producer, came to me and said, Bob, you know, you're stealing this picture. I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, really? He said, you're really coming across strong in this picture. And as the dailies continued, 3 and 4 and 5 weeks into it, again, Marty Rantzehoff said, you have stolen this picture. He said, and damn it, I think you're going to get a nomination out of this.
He was right.
So he called that shot very early on.
In Scarface, you played a Jewish-Cuban drug dealer. What did you do to get the accent?
Well, Al Pacino and I and Steve Bauer studied with an acting coach here, Robert Easton, and we would work all day working on this, the very specific nature of the Cuban accent, which would be different from the Mexican accent or a Spanish accent. The Cubans have a different rhythm. It's quite rapid fire.
And you had to be able to say Yiddish idioms and with a Cuban accent.
Yeah, let me tell you what Jase is, yes.
Right.
Yo crecí Tona Montana. It was interesting to play a Cuban Jew. Talk about character acting. But we talked all day. We rehearsed for 3 weeks, and if Al and I would go out to dinner at night, we'd continue talking in our accents. So we never let it go.
You play a police lieutenant in The Believers. You have a bit of a temper in the movie, and I think you're really good at raising your voice, really getting carried away.
Well, I don't know. I guess so. I'm not that way as a person. Actually, I'm a very easygoing, soft-spoken guy, really.
That's one thing I'm noticing talking to you now, that you really seem very soft-spoken. And in several of your roles, in a lot of your recent roles, let me put it that way, so much of your language is just sprinkled with expletives.
Right. Yeah, I'm even not all that happy about, when I read Sam Ransom in Jagged Edge, when I read that script, I said, you really want me to, say all this? And especially coming off Scarface, which had been bad rap because that used the word like over 200 times. And that can be tiresome. It's tiresome when you hear men or women in fact, as a matter of fact, just using gutter language,
You've played so many heavies and also detectives and cops. Can you ever use that to your advantage? I'm thinking, I don't know if you've ever pulled something like this, but have you ever been on the verge of getting mugged or being in a room with someone who's vaguely threatening? And have you tried to, turn on the kind of power that you have in those roles to scare them a little bit?
No, I've never done that. But it was a danger for a while that I was nailed down because I had... There was a period in my career where I had to make sort of a comeback from oblivion because I had dropped out of work for about 4 or 5 years. And to reestablish my credentials, so to speak, in Los Angeles, I was between 74 and 80, I did a lot of episodic television playing heavies. And I wasn't as well known, so to speak, as I am now. And... if I would go into a store, say, quite often there would be, I'd notice that the person would look up, see my face, and take an immediate step back. There was a subliminal reaction that this guy's bad news.
Like you were going to rob them or something.
Right, because they had seen an episode of whatever, whether it was Magnum or Mannix, or any of those shows, SWAT, that I had been doing. To answer your question, though, I never used that character to scare people or throw my weight around. No, that I was talking with Bert. Went out to dinner with Bert Reynolds. We became good friends. That when you play a tough guy, that you really have to watch the local yokel coming at you and say, "I can take you, baby," and want to have a fight with you.
Has that happened to you? Has that been a
No, problem? That has never happened to me. But it has happened to Bert. And I believe it's happened to Sly Stallone. I did a picture with Sly. Sly has to have guys around him to where it's dangerous. Sly's gotten death threats, from idiots. But no, that's never happened to me. I would hate for that to happen, you know, for a guy to want to mix it up because I play, you know, say you're not so tough, that sort of thing, cause, you know, to mix you up with the roles you play.
Are you tough?
Yeah, I am tough.
Does feeling you could take someone out make you more convincing in a role when you have to do that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I did a series called THE Cat. I don't know if you remember. That was back in 68. It was a very physical guy. And when I was younger, especially, I played very, very, I'm very gifted physically. And I'm able to do my own stunts and all that stuff. And now I'm on such a roll of doing terrific pictures, working with terrific actors and directors, that I'm quite happy to be able to express the range that I feel I have.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in more roles. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Great to talk to you. Bye.
Robert Loggia can be seen in the new film, The Believers. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's new for the show today?
Well, we're following the Iran-Contra hearings today, and we hope we'll have a report on the Soviet Central Committee, the party meeting in Moscow. And we'll also have more than our usual amount of music on the program today.
Like what, for instance?
Like Ravi Shankar, for instance, and also this.
John Paul, Holy Father, God called you by name. John Paul, Holy Father, humbly you came.
Leon Zarsky of Hamtramck, Michigan, that is, who has written a song for the Pope. He's a Grammy Award winner for his polkas, but this is a piece in honor of the Pope's coming to America later this year.
Okay. Well, I was going to guess it was him, Robert.
I can never fool you.
Yeah, hey, just kidding. Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Steve Martin's new movie, Roxanne, is set in a ski resort town out west, and the town isn't the only thing in this film that has a big slope. Our movie critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
You remember Cyrano de Bergerac, right? Edmond Rostand's hero was the smartest, bravest, wittiest, and most skillful sword fighter in all Europe. But he had this problem. His nose was so huge that he was sure the woman he loved, Roxanne, would never give him the time of day. And when a handsome young swain fell for her, Cyrano used his daunting literary skills to help the lad woo her. He wrote passionate letters in the lovesick dolt's name, and then he coached the boy in the art of muttering sweet nothings under a lady's window. The story's wonderful nonsense, but it would take a courageous man indeed to update it to an era when swordplay has vanished, and nose jobs are everywhere. That's exactly what Steve Martin has done, and he's done a bang-up job. Where Cyrano de Bergerac thundered and kicked, Roxanne blithely floats. True, Steve Martin hasn't solved the plastic surgery problem, and his screenplay isn't quite funny enough to match the original play's swirling wit. The supporting actors are mostly wasted, especially the great Shelley Duvall, and the ending of the movie dribbles when it ought to surge. Still, the funny stuff is funny in a way that's at once touchingly courtly and completely wacko. Here, for instance, is Steve Martin as Cyrano, coaching handsome but dumb Rick Rossovich as he woos the object of both their desires, Daryl Hannah.
So why'd you say those things?
Why'd he say those things?
Tell her you were afraid.
Because I was afraid.
Of me? What do you mean you were afraid? You're afraid of what?
Tell her you were afraid of words.
What?
Words.
Because I was afraid of worms, Roxanne, worms.
Although Daryl Hannah conveys Roxanne's beauty more convincingly than her brains, Big Rick Rossovich is immensely likable as the lunk who loves her. He's a wimp in a stud's body, and he knows it. But this is Steve Martin's movie. He's turned Cyrano into the fire chief of a small Washington resort town called Nelson, and the director, Fred Skepsy, has given Nelson a magical, airy brightness that tells you at once why a Cyrano might choose to settle there. Still, it's a pretty dinky place, and any real swashbuckler would be too big for it. But Martin's Cyrano pours all his ferocious energy and wit into navigating it anyway, and that's what's so moving and funny about Martin's performance. Even the way he walks down the street becomes an act of derring-do. In Roxanne, Steve Martin gets to the core of the play, because he understands that what makes Cyrano an outsider is not his enormous nose, but the enormous heroism it symbolizes. It may sound odd to say this, especially if you still think of Martin as that weirdo with the arrow through his head, but he's become an actor of extraordinary breadth and subtlety. I'll go even farther. Roxanne proves what many of us have long believed, that right now, Steve Martin is the finest comic actor working in the movies.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with detective writer James Crumley. His hard-boiled fiction has brought comparisons with Dashiell Hammett and Ross MacDonald. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone comments on two comedies about black stereotypes, the play The Colored Museum and the movie Hollywood Shuffle. And rhythm guitarist Marty Gross plays and sings music by one of his inspirations, Fats Waller. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests, while they're in Philadelphia, are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of the city's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.